For the some 2.2 million people diagnosed with schizophrenia in the U.S., hearing voices can be devastating and debilitating.
Who are you talking to? Tell me who you see.
How do you say Charles Herman in Russian?
There's no one there, John. There's no one there.
He's right there. He's right there. Stop. I don't know anything. Stop. My name is John Nash. I'm being held against my will.
For people like mathematician John Nash, played by Russell Crowe in the 2001 film A Beautiful Mind, hearing voices can torture and torment, and the solution has long been to try and silence those voices. But for doctoral psychology researcher Eleanor Longden, when she first heard a voice in her mind, it didn't feel like the symptom of a disease. It began as neutral and unobtrusive, a quiet voice that narrated her actions. She told a therapist and was quickly diagnosed with schizophrenia. And as she tried to make the voice go away, it multiplied, becoming increasingly louder and more aggressive, goading and antagonizing her. After failed treatments and hospitalizations, Longden came to reject the idea that her voices needed silencing. Instead, she now believes that they're part of her personality and her very being, and a reflection of the trauma she suffered from being sexually abused as a child. Instead of working against the voices in her head, Longden now works with them. She's chronicled her journey towards understanding herself and her voices in her new TED ebook, Learning from the Voices in My Head.
It began when I was about 18, when I was feeling very overwhelmed, very confused, very anxious, very sort of conflicted internally. And it was around this time that the voice began. And at this point, it was only a single voice. It was very, very mundane because all it used to do is narrate what I was doing in the third person. So it's kind of a sort of technical commentary, things like, you know, she is going to a lecture or she is going to the library. Initially, it certainly did feel startling. It was quite a weird, eerie sensation, sense almost of being intruded and imposed upon. But because it didn't fit with any of my sort of preconceptions about what voice hearing was, I became accustomed to it quite rapidly. And I was rather excited about it because I'd recently became aware that the voice actually provided some intriguing insights into my emotional state.
But so then you told your friend about it, and what was their response?
Well, I was telling her about this and sort of genuinely excited and positive, and she looked utterly horrified. Her fear and her mistrust and her suspicion of this experience was infectious, because it immediately began to plant this what would prove quite a devastating seed, which says voice hearing equals insanity. Suddenly this was no longer an experience, it was becoming a symptom.
And when that happened, when somebody said to you, you know what, I think you have schizophrenia, the voices changed. They weren't this sort of neutral speakers anymore. They became quite hostile.
Absolutely right. The way I describe it sometimes is as a psychic civil war, in that you are increasingly beginning to take an aggressive, hostile, mistrustful stance against your own mind. Your mind, you're being told, is the problem. Your mind is diseased. You have a bad brain. And as somebody whose mind had always been the main source of comfort and consolation and coping, because that was how I always approached any kind of difficulty in my life, was in an intellectual way, again, as somebody who was very afraid of emotion. This seemed devastating. It seemed like the ultimate betrayal that my mind had let me down.
How did the mental health system deal with you then?
My initial contact with the mental health system, I think, can be summed up in three words, which was diagnosed, drugged, and discarded. Basically, I was getting the message that, you know, the past experiences of trauma and victimization were irrelevant, that what was happening to me could be formulated very simply in terms of this carnivorous brain disease called schizophrenia. And that was very, very frightening and very disempowering, and filled me with this really quite toxic, poisonous sense of just hopelessness and humiliation and despair about myself. It, you know, made me believe there's absolutely nothing I could do to help myself except take medication and hope for the best. And in my case, medication was not effective.
And what in the end was effective? I mean, it even got to the point where there was self-mutilation, where there was really, you were institutionalized. And how did you claw back from that?
I was certainly in a very bad way. And I think for a while my family sort of mourned for me as if I had literally died. You know, it seemed like the person that I'd been had just gone. In my own journey, you know, there is no anti-abuse medication. There is no anti-trauma pill. There was nothing that could take away what had happened to me. What needed to change was the way I understood, interpreted and appraised it. And I didn't actually have any formal therapy until I was in my late 20s. So initially, it wasn't based on, you know, structured psychological therapy. It was much more about healing relationships, really, and essentially making sense of the voices and realizing that they basically represented parts of me, and that actually the most negative, the most aggressive and the most hostile, frightening voices actually represented the parts of me that had been hurt the most. And it was those voices that needed the greatest compassion and care.
So is your message to people or to the medical world that the way we currently diagnose and treat schizophrenia is wrong or misguided, or too many people are getting a label slapped on them when maybe there are other reasons? And do you feel like this is changing?
I think my own stance is to have the meaning of my experiences almost taken away from me and reformulated in terms of brain disease felt profoundly unhelpful, and it was almost insult to injury in a way, because having survived some quite extreme experiences, rather than being sort of honored for that, and, you know, rather than people saying, wow, you know, you've survived all this, how have you done it? It felt like yet another process of silencing and denial.
Do you still hear the voices, or have they turned more into a sort of inner dialogue that we all have?
I do still hear them. And I mean, they can occasionally still be quite undermining. And they will do that if something's distressing in my life, or if I'm feeling very overwhelmed, then the voices will get worse. But I would genuinely miss them if they went, which is an extraordinary thing to say, because I was somebody who, you know, many years ago would literally wanted to die rather than live with these tormentors. But by engaging with them, understanding them, making peace with them, which again, for me, represented, you know, becoming more peaceful and compassionate and accepting towards myself, because the voices are, you know, embodied parts of me. The voices have actually been a really important part of my healing process.
Eleanor, you have a fascinating story. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
Eleanor Longden is now a doctoral psychology researcher and the author of the TED Talk, The Voices in My Head.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.